This is The Takeaway for Friday, May 27th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And every day, 55 million kids go to school in America in grades K through 12. This week, I suppose they're looking at the calendar for summer vacation. Our society, though, has deemed it essential that they all learn to read, write, and do rudimentary math. There is consensus that the schools be a place to learn appropriate competition, self-esteem, social skills. I know you're saying, hey, Hockenberry, tell me something I don't know. Okay, hang in there. We have a broad consensus that sports and physical activity are important, less of a consensus that art and music should be taught in the schools. Well, anything missing?
There are 17 million kids in the United States, 18 and under, who have or have had a psychiatric disorder that causes them distress and dysfunction. And left untreated, they're more likely to drop out of school.
Dr. Harold Koplowitz is a child and adolescent psychiatrist and president of the nonprofit Child Mind Institute. He says this country is missing a huge opportunity and making a giant public health mistake by not having mental health services available at school every day for every student, not just in some special ed program. 80% of chronic mental disorders that we identify in adults begin during youth. Just like the successes we see in adults, they come from successes experienced in school. Dr. Koplowitz wants to get a conversation going in this country to address mental health and a host of other problems as well. His experience as a child psychiatrist for 30 years has made him a believer that the possibilities for huge social change are right there in the classroom, if Americans are just willing to agree that they are as important as reading and math and Band-Aids from the nurse.
Around 22% of the population under the age of 18 who have one of these disorders. So they're not hiding. They're right there. And mental health disorders, as well as learning disabilities, are barriers to learning. They make learning more difficult. And if we as a society would like everyone to be productive, I think it's important that we give everyone, whether they're in a wheelchair or whether they're hearing impaired or whether they have a psychiatric disorder, the right to an education. And I think there's a myth and a misconception that kids with psychiatric disorders are dangerous. They are certainly not likely to hurt anybody else. They're at higher risk of hurting themselves than the average kid. But more importantly, they are usually the ones who are just either more disruptive or quietly ignored and isolated in school. And I think it's really a matter of turning this around that would help all children. So schools that are using positive behavioral intervention support, these are schools where they have decided that from top to bottom, they're going to be focusing on positive behavior. In fact, every parent in America should try this so that when your child is doing something that you want them to do, that you've given a request and they've met the request, is that we label that behavior positively. Thank you for listening to me so attentively. Thank you for cleaning up after I asked you to, instead of focusing on the child in the classroom who is distracting, who's out of his seat and constantly saying, sit down, sit down. How many times do I have to tell you this? Are you deaf? And so schools that have refocused themselves on a positive behavior are amazed at how positive behavior goes from being the underdog in school to really the thing that everyone wants to do.
Does this require training of teachers? And is that what they're doing in Chile, where they seem to have a much more aggressive program than we do in the United States?
I think the important part is not only training teachers, it's using your school psychologist, your mental health slash guidance counselors differently, and making the entire school think about these disorders in a different way and saying, we're not here to be a mental health clinic, but we're not going to be foolish enough to ignore that at least one out of five of our kids are suffering with these problems. So just think about it. If one out of five kids came to school and were physically handicapped, and we decided not to provide ramps, we decided that we weren't going to let wheelchairs or crutches into the classroom.
For decades, that's exactly what we did.
Correct. And America could do better. I was very disturbed that when one of the shootings occurred in California recently, one of the candidates say, just get used to it. Disturbed people try to fall through the cracks. Well, that's just not America. America is the kind of place that took on polio, took on AIDS, took on seatbelts. And so this is a nation that is very capable of turning around this problem. It's unacceptable that we have a school dropout rate of almost 40% for kids who come to school with a learning disability and an emotional disturbance. If we can turn that around while they're in school, which is where they work, where we know they exist, where they come on a regular basis, we can turn around the high school graduation rates. And most importantly, we can have productive citizens. Kids who are thrown out of school or are suspended, expelled, are much more likely to get in trouble with the law, more likely to use drugs, are more likely to have interaction with the juvenile justice system.
At the risk of sounding argumentative, but wanting really to underscore the big idea here, let me just play the cynic for a moment before we go. Come on, Doc. The mental health system in America is called the prison system. That's what every warden tells us on this show when we interview them. We're dealing with it. We're handling it. May not be the best, but this is the system we've chosen. Nobody wants to change it. And, you know, putting a few counselors in schools isn't going to do anything about it.
Well, I think it's much more than putting a few counselors into schools. I think it's retraining the counselors we have. It means making an additional investment in retraining teachers. It's really interesting that if you look for Teach for America, these are some of the smartest, most energetic, ambitious kids who want to become teachers. And they really master the art of teaching kids how to read and write relatively and do math really quickly. And we find that when we teach them how to do behavioral management and how to manage their own stress, they become better teachers, the kids behave better, and the kids also perform better. So I don't think America has chosen a prison system that is really a mental health system. I think this is a default position. I think it's one of those times where it is time to really look carefully at this problem that we have that really affects every American. It's not only poor Americans, it's rich Americans, it's white, black, and Hispanic. These are equal opportunity disorders. And if we care about the future of our nation, both economically and I think ethically, we really have to re-engineer and rethink how we're going to deal with the mental health and learning disorders that our children have that present in schools today.
Is there a particular story of a particular young person who maybe motivated you to be as passionate about this as you appear to be?
Many, many years ago, I saw a boy who came to me begrudgingly, because very rarely do children come to see a child psychiatrist on their own volition or their own desire. And he was in second grade, and he was struggling in a very competitive school. And the only thing he really enjoyed was baseball. But there was no doubt that he was very hyperactive and very inattentive. And this was literally 30 years ago. And it was unclear, but I thought he also had a real bad reading problem. I went to the school to watch him, and I thought his teacher was really mean. And why? What I mean is that every time something bad happened in the classroom, she turned around and she picked on Jason. It wasn't every time it was Jason, but she was just playing the odds. And Jason was really demoralized by going to school. And eventually, I was able to convince his parents that he truly had attention deficit disorder. We were able to treat it. And unfortunately, once he was more attentive and he was able to sit still, it became very clear that he also had dyslexia, that he was just guessing at words. He couldn't decode the language. And this particular school was for gifted kids. And so he lost his seat there and had to go to a more regular mainstream kind of school for, let's say, average kids. And that's a pretty good outcome. But around 25 years later, I actually get a call from him. And he said to me, there's an economic tsunami out there. This was 2009. And I think I've lost my business. My marriage is in trouble. I really need to see someone. I said, fine, tell me where you are and where you live, and I'll get you the name of a really good psychiatrist. And he said to me, I don't want to see a really good psychiatrist. I want to see you. And I said, well, I'm a child psychiatrist. He said, but you're my child psychiatrist. And what was really impressive about this interaction, because he did come in to see me, is that he even felt, when he thought back to second grade, that here was someone who understood who he was and wanted to make his everyday life better. Because if we didn't do something for him, if he would have remained in that school, eventually he would have been so demoralized that he would have dropped out if they didn't expel him or suspend him. And so you can imagine how hard it is for kids to be required to do what everyone else does that is easy for them, but is super hard for these kids. Every day, they have to climb a mountain. And it seems unjust and unfair that we don't show them how you can get up that mountain, but you need some accommodations. You need people who really understand what they're experiencing. Because if you do that, then you turn school into a place where kids are running and want to go to school and are enthusiastic about the fact that they're learning something, and in turn, they have great academic success.
Dr. Harold Koplowitz, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Harold Koplowitz is a child and adolescent psychiatrist and president of the Child Mind Institute. As Dr. Koplowitz said, 17 million U.S. kids have a mental health disorder. Are you a family affected? From Atlanta, Georgia, I have a child with a mental health disorder. I rely heavily on mental health professionals along with friends and family.
My name is Maddie. I'm calling from Salt Lake City. Mental illness has shaped my life completely. I've grown to embrace the downs when they come, enjoy the good days, and take measures to minimize the amount of time I spend down. I take antidepressants, and I'm very grateful for the few people who have helped me rather than shun me due to the stigma surrounding my disease.
My name is Chris from Coraopolis, Pennsylvania, outside Pittsburgh, and I'm a mental health counselor, and I work with kids. My experience tells me that we are relying too much on disorder label rather than parenting. Most of my ADHD clients simply were not given structure in the home and now are out of control, and the parents are looking for other people to fix them.
Lynn, Massachusetts, diagnosed with bipolar disorder at 11, horrible teenage years gave way to a fantastic but still shaken adulthood.
We've dealt with this sort of challenge in both our family and church and school settings. Coping begins with finding good information and advocacy and the building a support network to assist families who may find barriers to involvement without help. Our Quaker churches offer training to members so families with children with particular needs can participate in activities, knowing their children are safe and engaged.
When I was 30, I was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. I found a therapist who was able to diagnose this and offer a path for treatment. I asked him, can this be cured? And he said, sure. I said, how long will it take? He said, about 10 years. I said, 10 years? But I'll be 40. He's like, you know, in 10 years, you're going to be 40 anyway. You want to be 40 like this? I started treatment the next day. It took 11 years. But now at age 50, can't believe how great the world looks.
Anoka, Minnesota. My 10-year-old lives with severe generalized anxiety. He just completed 6 weeks in a partial hospitalization program. There are so many barriers to treatment that aren't there for other health disorders. I have set aside my career in order to be able to deal with it. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. Comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Coming up, community colleges are coping with an alarming rise in students with mental health needs, but they are vastly underfunded. A 2012 survey found that just 13% of community colleges provide psychiatric services compared to 56% of four-year colleges and universities. It's one angle in our community college series coming up on The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, working to advance cutting-edge research and cures and committed to helping to make someday today for thousands of blood cancer patients. Learn more at lls.org.
Those mental health issues we spoke about earlier this hour among grade school students eventually, if they don't drop out, graduate from high school into college. The organization Single Stop USA has programs in more than 10 communities around the country. It's a nonprofit that tries to be there for financially vulnerable students dealing with the stress of college.
I was at a meeting recently at one of our single stops, and the site coordinator that I was meeting with was running late. And when she finally walked in, she said, I'm so sorry, I had a student that was suicidal, came into my office this morning. And so I really need to stay with her, which of course, absolutely you have to stay with her. The student had been very upset, couldn't complete school, couldn't keep her job. And the single stop coordinator worked with her through suicide prevention resources, resources for childcare, work resources, financial aid resources, sat with her and sent her to several referrals and I think changed the student's life.
That's Christy Reeves, CEO of Single Stop. Reeves works in tandem with another nonprofit, Wisconsin Hope Lab, which identifies problems that Single Stop responds to. Wisconsin Hope Lab founder Sarah Goldrick-Robb says college requires an emotional readiness that most schools don't deal with.
While some people choose these colleges as their first choice, and that is where they would want to go no matter what, in a lot of cases, people basically find their way there because it is the place and the only place that is accessible to them. And so what that means is you're going to get more people who, yes, are going through some sort of employment crisis or have gone through major changes in their lives, are recently divorced, and they're there to get trained so they can go get a job. And these have been wonderful places, frankly, for opening their doors to society writ large and serving them. But we're also at a moment when they are severely strapped in terms of financial resources. And so their ability to meet the needs of these folks that are coming to them are constrained. And I think oftentimes the students don't really know that.
How much do socioeconomic factors in community colleges or in the colleges that you studied bear on the need for mental health services?
I think that they definitely are playing a role. I mean, the vast majority of low-income students who go to college in this country go to community colleges. And the average income at community colleges is lower. The use of financial aid is higher. And yet, I also have to say that one of the reasons that people are struggling so much is that the cost of attending community college is a lot more than probably most of your listeners would understand or expect it to be. The average cost out of pocket for a low-income person to attend a community college today, after all grants and scholarships are taken into account, is an average of over $8,000 a year. And so you have a lot of folks there who, frankly, are struggling to pay that price. That's contributing to their stress levels. And when they need something like health services or medication, they can't afford it.
Whose responsibility is this? Do the community colleges understand that this is something they need to be involved in, like, remediation in terms of dealing with people who are coming out of high school who need extra skills, some of the responsibilities that community colleges have taken on? Or is this just sort of out there in limbo?
To be honest, I think that this question of responsibility is a really hard one because on the one hand, they want to take responsibility and help students. And on the other hand, they are not deciding their financial situations. These are state institutions funded by states and localities. So the real responsibility, frankly, lies with those who set the budgets for these schools to make sure that, for example, they can hire counselors who can help. You know, the ratio of counselors to students at community colleges, there is one counselor for every 3,000 community college students. At four-year institutions, it's 1 to 1,600. We do this thing in higher education that we don't find acceptable in K-12, which is that we devote the most resources to the schools with the already wealthiest people. And we leave these other institutions without what they need. So I think that the responsibility issue is a big one. And I think we would see a very different situation at community colleges if we said, look, you have the money. Just spend it on these things that need to be addressed.
How much of the problems that you're seeing in community colleges are a consequence of a society where there really is no tradition for offering and maintaining access to mental health in all areas of life?
Yeah, I can't quantify it, but what I can tell you is that some of the reaction I've heard to this report that we did was, well, yeah, I mean, who's not depressed? Are we really worried that people are anxious? That's so normalized as just a, it's not thought of as a real hindrance. It's just thought of sort of a fact of life. But we don't pay attention until there's a suicide. I mean, I'm looking at numbers here that really upset me. I mean, we've got young people in this survey, people under the age of 25, and at the community colleges, more than 6% have a suicide plan. At four-year schools, that's about 3.5%. I mean, a suicide plan in mind, and we're not putting the resources in place. How many of these folks have to follow through on a plan like that until we pay attention?
Solution? Is there a solution? Is there an institutional sort of change here? Is it institution by institution?
I think, first of all, I mean, even introducing mental health into this conversation about what we're producing, quote unquote, in higher education, these degrees, and considering mental health a factor such that we could get students on track with good mental health at the beginning of college and they would produce degrees faster, I do think that some of this is awareness. So I think there's a lot that we could do if we decided that this was a priority.
Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is founder of Wisconsin Hope Lab. She spoke with us from Madison, Wisconsin. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
I am Gunnery Sergeant Hartman, your senior drill instructor.
What's the best way to go about disarming one of these things? The way you're doing dice, sir.
Sir, yes, sir.
Private Joker, why did you join my beloved Corps?
Sir, to kill, sir.
I apologize. It's not my fault. The waves are getting blown out by the napalm.
Let me see your war face.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday for Friday Movies. Welcome.
Hi, John.
And for this weekend, we've got Alice Through the Looking Glass, a sequel to the Tim Burton.
That's correct, but without Tim Burton this time.
Go back in time? How?
The Chronosphere.
None of us can use it because we've already been in the past. And if your past self sees your future self, what happens? There is no history of it happening, but it is said that if it were to happen, everything would be history.
Lewis Carroll probably wouldn't recognize much of that language, but I recognize Helena Bonham Carter there.
Helena Bonham Carter, Anne Hathaway, Johnny Depp, they're all back. Mia Wasikowska as Alice. But as I said, no Tim Burton, and I think that's a big problem with this film. He didn't follow trends. You know, Tim Burton kind of is a trend. And this movie, I think, is trying to take little bits and pieces from everything else that's out there in the culture. It feels a little bit like Wicked, a little bit like an origin story. And I have to say, Johnny Depp is the Mad Hatter. I don't know if you were a fan of him in the original film, but here he's really bordering on the horrifying. He's got these eyes that seem a little bit computer altered. He looks a little like a fish. I can't get behind that character, and this was really not an enjoyable sequel.
Maybe he has a future in the X-Men Apocalypse. That's the next film here.
Ever since the world found out about mutants in 73, there have been cults who see them as some kind of second coming or sign of God. I was tracking one of them. They call themselves a Shir En Sebanur, named after an ancient being they believe to be the world's first.
World's first what?
The world's first mutant.
As if anyone needed an explanation. We believe in the mutants now. Everyone's all there. There doesn't need to be any exposition.
That's right. Although what's odd about it is that the critics have generally loved the X-Men movies. We always think of these as being the kind of more stylish, more intelligent superhero films. And the critics have turned against this en masse. They have despised, hated, loathed this film. I don't think it's that bad. Oscar Isaac plays this mutant that we're talking about there. Jennifer Lawrence is back. Michael Fassbender is great as Magneto. Yeah, it's a little sluggish. It doesn't have quite the snap and the crackle that the other X-Men films do. But I'm not sure why everyone is hating on this movie so much. It seems like a straight down the middle superhero installment to me.
Did they dare to go after Jennifer Lawrence?
They did, and I have to say she is a little bit on autopilot in this film. It's true.
Yeah, she doesn't need that film.
No, she doesn't.
But Colin Farrell, on the other hand, probably does need a hit at this point. The Lobster, a very interesting movie. We actually talked with Colin Farrell and the director of this movie.
Now, have you thought of what animal you'd like to be if you end up alone?
Yes, a lobster.
Why a lobster?
Because lobsters live for over 100 years. Are blue-blooded like aristocrats.
I must congratulate you. The first thing most people think of is a dog.
Now, that is the premise of the movie right there.
That's right. If you are a single person in this strange dystopian world, you have 45 days to find a mate or you are turned into an animal of your choice. This is one of those movies that creates this very strange, very absurd, very dark world and thinks it through so totally. Every detail is so rich and so weird and unexpected. Very Charlie Kaufman-esque, I would say, very Kafka-esque. It's just a very, very bizarre, funny, really interesting comedy. I really loved this film.
That's great. Well, it sounded wonderful. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday on Alice Through the Looking Glass, X-Men Apocalypse. Forget about those, Ryan.
I say forget about those and go with the lobster.
Go with the lobster. I'll have the lobster, yes. I'll have
excellent
two.
Choice.
Thank you. Rafer, have a great weekend.
You too, John. Thanks.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Staples, offering printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals. At Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
Throughout the vast expanse of Canada, these stories are not native folklore, but they are common to virtually every Indigenous family. Here is Melina Labucan-Massimo.
My sister Bella was found dead
2 years and not just under 9 months ago. It was probably one of the worst phone calls I've ever received in my life. She just actually graduated from college. She had left our community in the province of Alberta to move to Toronto to go to fashion school, and just graduated, and 3 months later she was found dead, and her case is still unsolved and listed as suspicious.
Since 1980, up to 4,000 Indigenous women in Canada have gone missing. Although Indigenous women only make up about 4% of the country's population, they account for 16% of all homicides, 11% of all missing people. This reality became a grisly crime story for Vancouver detective Laura Mershenhur.
We knew quite early on who the suspect was in this, who became Canada's largest serial killer. I had a tip the second day on the job, and I could not get the resources and the people in place to actually arrest this man or conduct an investigation in order to arrest him. And I think that that's the tragedy, because there's that overarching attitude that these women don't matter, these investigations don't matter.
Shenher told her story of discovery and change at an emotional panel discussion last month at the Women in the World Conference in New York City. Also there was Carolyn Bennett, who Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau appointed minister to lead a reconciliation project with Indigenous women.
The whole of our government is going to have to fix this. We know it's not going to be overnight, but we will launch a national public inquiry to get to these root causes, and we're going to put in place some of the things that we can do right now that the families have been talking about for a very long time, and it's time that we get on with it.
And with me now is Dawn Lavelle Harvard, president of the Native Women's Association of Canada, the association that first raised awareness of this problem that's now recognized at the United Nations.
Well, thank goodness the government has finally opened its eyes. Thank goodness they have finally admitted that this is a problem. It was beyond ridiculous. It was appalling to see how the government can look at lists, you know, 1,200 missing and murdered Indigenous women documented by their own national police force, well documented, and, you know, across the media, across the country from this report. And the Canadian government under Prime Minister Harper continued to say that this was not a problem. This was not a priority. This was not an issue. And that kind of attitude obviously contributed to the crisis when your own government is saying it's not happening despite what everybody is seeing around them. So to see the change in attitude is that first step, is that first ray of hope that things are going to change for our future generations, because that was the first step that was necessary, as it was the ignorance and the silence and the deliberate hiding of this crisis by the former government that was increasing the danger for our women. Because as long as people were saying, or that they were blaming the women, and that was one of the biggest problems with the former government, was this attitude that the women had high-risk lifestyles, that they were engaging in high-risk behaviors. And yes, many Indigenous women live in high-risk lifestyles, but it's not a lifestyle choice. It's because of poverty.
Can Carolyn Bennett, the Canadian minister who was appointed to deal with this reconciliation, really understand what goes on in the hearts of these women and families who have had this experience and who fear the future? Or is something like this suspiciously like the sort of colonial masters coming in and, you know, giving you guys Bibles?
Well, to the extent that she's not an Indigenous woman and has not grown up in a community in third world conditions, no, she could never really understand what it feels like to grow up in that kind of situation, what it feels like to live in that kind of situation and have the kind of hopelessness and despair that, I mean, we see the outcome with the extremely high rate of suicide. Our Indigenous young people in Canada have the highest rate of suicide in the world. We have heard at the UN that it's the highest rate in the world. So to that extent, no, she could never really understand what that feels like. But unlike most people, she has actually sat down with the families of the missing and murdered. She has sat with them while they cried their tears. She has experienced their pain. Unlike previous governments, unlike others who very often just simply turn away, I mean, she has gone and from coast to coast and spent day after day, week after week, experiencing that pain. So to the extent that anybody who has never lived it can understand it, I think she understands it better than most. But to a certain extent, no, having never experienced that kind of despair and that kind of abject poverty, she couldn't really understand what that kind of hopelessness that would drive you to take your own life or that would drive you to desperate circumstances is like for somebody who lives in those kind of conditions.
What kind of awareness is going to be required by the nation at large in Canada to address this issue and to bring a kind of justice between groups that have lived side by side for more than a century?
Well, I think the Truth and Reconciliation Commission has been a pivotal turning point in the awareness of everybody else in the country, because the horrors of the deliberate abuse, the deliberate removal of children, it can no longer be seen in this country as, you know, a well-intentioned educational experiment that just went wrong. It is now a matter of public record, and that the stories of the survivors of the residential school are now out there for people to understand that it was a deliberate act of aggression and violence against children and against our peoples. And people are now really understanding the horror of the residential school experience. And so there has been a greater awareness. They can no longer pretend that this was just well-intentioned and you people didn't try hard enough. That is the first step towards the larger population understanding how Indigenous people end up in the circumstances that they're in now, and they can get away from, you know, the blaming the victim attitudes and the old-fashioned bootstrapism. I mean, it's very hard to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps if you don't have boots, and you don't have boots because the colonizers have come in and taken everything you had, including your children.
Dawn Laval-Harbert is president of the Native Women's Association of Canada. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
At Indianapolis, super-powered cars thunder toward the starting line, and they're off in the world's greatest auto racing classic. Averaging as high as 129 miles an hour, the speedsters whiz around and around in a race that's 500 miles long, with a chance of trouble every foot of the way.
Wow. I have a feeling the speeds at the Indy 500 are far higher these days. This Sunday marks the 100th running of the Indianapolis 500. More than 200,000 fans will pack the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Millions more will be tuning in, eagerly watching 33 of the bravest and most skilled racers zip around the 2.5-mile track in state-of-the-art vehicles at over 200 miles an hour. Quinn Kleinfelter, senior news editor at WDET in Detroit, is in Indianapolis this weekend. He says even with all the economic problems in the auto racing industry and the auto industry over the past century, the Indy 500 is still the race to win.
It's the kind of a race where if you're able to do well in it, it almost doesn't matter what happens in the entire rest of your career, or vice versa. If you mess up, even at this point in time, you could be persona non grata forever within auto racing circles. There's one person I talked to, being down at the Speedway recently, that really has a good handle on all of that. One of the most famous names in auto racing, Mario Andretti. And yet, when I talked to Mario, he said, when you look at Indy, there's just simply nothing that compares.
This is probably the only race on the motor race on the planet that is worth a championship, if you will. You're judged by that. There are great drivers that never won this race, and they're great drivers, capable of doing it, but didn't have the luck. Probably if this race was 400 miles, I would have won it six times, that type of thing. I only have one race to show for. And how many did I dominate?
What is an Indy car that makes it different from the other kinds of races, particularly NASCAR?
It's what they call an open wheel racing, meaning that the tires stick out to either side and there's no fenders. They've tried to put things to try to block some of those tires because it's easy for a car behind you to run into these and bounce up and off of the track. I mean, picture it's as if you're laying on a sofa with your legs out in front of you and your butt literally just an inch or two off of the ground. You have tires that are almost the size of your head, you know, that you're trying to look around. And you're doing a 250 miles an hour about on the straightaways. I mean, we're talking takeoff speed for some jet aircraft, which is why they have the wings on them. They're like upside down airplane wings to push the car onto the track rather than lift it off the ground. So it's a very technical thing, and it's something that had really appealed to a big segment of people, at least for the longest time. They hit this period in the 1990s, and suddenly the bottom dropped out.
Why was there a split, and do they still talk about it today?
There was a fight for control over the sport of IndyCar racing. between the major team owners, the Roger Penskes, the Chip Ganassis, and the people that owned and operated their Super Bowl, the Indianapolis 500. In that case, in those days, it was Tony George. And they had such a division that they split into two separate series where the best teams and drivers went to one, and Tony George started his own series, the Indy Racing League, and kept the Indianapolis 500. So you had the Super Bowl of Indy Racing with like replacement players, and the top line first string guys were having their own series but couldn't go to the Super Bowl. It was something that destroyed in many ways the fan base for the Indy 500. Mario says that it caused a problem that is still echoing today.
We lost a generation after Tony George split the series. They all went to NASCAR because he brought NASCAR into mainstream by giving him Indianapolis. And touche to NASCAR. I mean, they made the most of it, you know. But meanwhile, we lost the fan base because the fan base felt cheated.
Certainly what Indy has going for it is the spectacle, the amazing spectacle of that speedway. Describe it. I mean, isn't it still the largest spectator sport arena in the world?
It is. It seats about 250,000 people if you look at the grandstands all the way around the track. The track itself is 2.5 miles around, and the grandstands encircle that, so they're further. Plus, they would fill in parts of the infield. It's so large, they have a 9-hole golf course inside the track. They also have a various things that they're trying to do, as you say, to try to make it more of an event now, as it's trying to not only compete with NASCAR, but with all the other things that come at sporting events, that come at the media, all the different things that people have to take their attention away. And advertisers, as is the media, as is sporting events like the Indy 500, they're all shooting oftentimes for the millennials. How do we get younger people involved? And when you talk to the Indy 500 officials, they'll say, well, we believe that we're very well positioned for that. You know, they may not have the bumping and grinding that NASCAR stock cars do, but the cars themselves are very technically advanced, and they have a lot of things that would work well, to be honest, on a phone app. They have telemetry from the pits. You can see by some radio waves just when the tire is starting to deflate so that it tells the pit crew so they can try to bring the guy in before it blows up on him. And there's other things that they're trying to do as well. I mean, this when you talk about the size of the track, you think of this infield, even the inside of the track alone is 250 acres. I mean, it's enough you could put Churchill Downs, Yankee Stadium, the Rose Bowl, the Roman Coliseum, Vatican City. You could fit all of those into the infield.
And that would help also, them. That would help them with millennials if they put it all
in. Well, they would. But well, they thought they would go beyond all that to try to get the millennials. So what they did is they're doing a 2016 version of Woodstock.
So on the 100th Indy, who are the favorites? Have they decided the poll?
Yeah, they have. And one of the things that is always a good thing about the Indy 500 is there, oftentimes anyways, is apart from the competition, there's some dramatic storylines. There's several now. There's a driver named Simon Pagenaud who has won the last three consecutive Indy car races and finished second in the other and is driving for Team Penske. So he is somebody that they think might have a very good chance of trying to win. And the person on the pole is a guy named James Hinchcliffe, who literally almost died in a crash last year. He hit the wall and had a piece of his suspension go into his car and through the side of it and actually impale him. And they were able to pull him through that, and he's back and not only competing, but he's starting in the front row on the pole position.
Old home week. It's the old and the new at the Indy 500, the 100th Indianapolis 500. Quinn Kleinfelder, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
When Captain America throws his mighty shield, all those who chose to oppose his shield must yield.
Nothing outranks the patriotism of Captain America.
I will champion the fight for freedom and justice wherever tyranny reigns.
Captain America is at the top of the red, white, and blue chain of command. Once just a normal human until the technological wizards during World War II made him into a secret weapon. You know the story.
Enter Steve Rogers, too puny to be accepted by the army, but willing to risk death for his country in the greatest experiment of all.
He drinks the mother of all performance-enhancing drugs and...
It's working. Don't give up, son. You must survive this crisis.
Suddenly, it is over. and America has a new champion.
He's a champion and the first superhero to also be a projection of American foreign policy.
The guy calls himself Captain America. It should be political.
The creators of this character were Jewish, and they used him to be like an ideology of what it means to be American.
That's right, Cap. You know what to do. Go get him.
I mean, the first Captain America comic, and he's punching Hitler in the face.
Of course he's punching Hitler in the face. None of this Hollywood Dark Knight existential angst and good hero, bad hero ambivalence. No. Captain America is solid. He's clear. He's right. Just like America. But hey, wait a minute.
I'm shocked, to be honest. It's weird. It does not feel right.
Baiting the world with anger. I'm surprised Trump hasn't written or said something about this already.
I mean, I'm not calling for death threats or anything like that they're doing on Twitter.
Death threats? Anger? Captain America gone weird? That's the comic world crisis of the moment, when the latest issue of the Captain America comic books this week delivered the backstory mind-boggler of all time. Something like Marilyn Monroe was actually a robot, or Alexander Hamilton came back from the dead and killed JFK. This storyline makes Captain America into a recruit of Hydra, the ultimate evil syndicate. Think of Hydra as Nazis.
Hydra created a world so chaotic that humanity is finally ready to sacrifice its freedom to gain its security. Once the purification process is complete, Hydra's new world order will arise.
Captain America, a recruit of Hydra? That's just,
I mean, I'm not calling for death threats or anything like that they're doing on Twitter.
Over at Carmine Street Comics in the West Village of Manhattan, a man calling himself Deadpool John says that it goes against more than just Cap's personality.
The creators of this character were Jewish, and they used him to be like an ideology of what it means to be American, regardless of this. And to say that he's always been a member of Hydra, it's weird. It does not feel right, and there's nowhere good you can go with this other than basically ruining a character that's been around for 75 years. The people that created him would have freaked out at this. This should not have happened.
Weird flashbacks and outlandish plot twists are what happen all the time in the comics, but this is different. And an enormous online backlash says that fandom isn't buying the new plotline. Should they?
Well, this is definitely part of a tradition.
John Gorga owns Carmine Street Comics, and he's seen a lot of outrageous political cliffhangers in his day.
There's been times where the book is a more straightforward superhero book dealing with crime or dealing with moral issues. But there's many times where Captain America has been distinctly about something more political. I mean, when the first Captain America comic, I think it was the summer of 1941, and he's punching Hitler in the face. At the time, it was a very political statement, and according to Richard Wright, who wrote a book called Comic Book Nation, he said in an interview on this topic that they were getting hate mail. They were getting hate mail at the Marvel Comics offices, then it was called Timely Comics, because it was obviously suggesting that America should be at war. The guy was wearing the flag, and he was punching Hitler. That would be like if today's Captain America comic had him punching Putin in the face. So definitely Captain America's had layers of political like undermessage from the very beginning. The guy calls himself Captain America. It should be political, especially since you're writing mostly for adults, which is really what superhero comics are now. Just, God, the readership is like 80 to 90% for adults.
Part of the tradition is actually being topical, like during the Watergate years, Gorga says.
In the 70s, post-Watergate, there was a storyline where he uncovers some kind of Hydra corruption in the government, and it was obviously meant to parallel what had been discovered in the real-world politics about what Nixon did. And he takes off the costume, and for, gosh, I don't know off the top of my head how long, maybe only a few months, maybe a few years, but for a time, Steve Rogers did not call himself Captain America. He called himself Nomad, the man without a country. I think that was 1973.
I can think of 15 ways they can back themselves out of this, and I hope they do it as soon as possible, because I'll tell you right now, I'm going to be reading it off the shelf, but I'm not paying for the rest of this arc unless they come out with something really, really good, and maybe I'll get the trade, but it's not acceptable.
What is acceptable? We try to write comics in 2016 that are about the world and the zeitgeist of 2016, particularly in Captain America, says an editor from Marvel. What's clear about the zeitgeist of 2016? Are we clear about the good guys and the bad guys when President Barack Obama lays a wreath at Ground Zero in Hiroshima to commemorate 140,000 civilians killed in 1945? Okay, forget that one. Just think about the 2016 presidential campaign. The Captain America writers tweet about that all the time.
The one thing that makes me genuinely concerned and angry is that the rumblings I'm hearing is that some actual neo-Nazis out there are very, like, happy and are saying, ah, this is proof Captain America's on our side, therefore, like, America is really on our side. The ideals of America are still being reflected in the idea of being a Nazi, which is... I'm surprised Trump hasn't written or said something about this already. It seems like the exact kind of baiting the world with anger and paying attention to surface things without going below the surface and actually talking about the issues kind of thing that he loves.
I mean, I'm not calling for death threats or anything like that they're doing on Twitter. That's disgusting, but this should not have happened.
But this has happened. And if Hollywood can take the art and artistry of the comics and turn it all into mass culture... surely the creators, writers, and artists in the comic world can try to make a mass media statement to provoke and challenge. A mission like Captain America, only it's landing on the op-ed pages.
Kill Captain America!
You will never achieve final victory, Zemo. No man can perpetrate evil without paying the price.
Enough talk! Stay back!
Captain America stretched too far? What's too strange for fiction, comics, or otherwise? I'd love to hear your stories. 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to thetakeaway.org. And here's something to take with you today. We've been speaking about moments and gestures of reconciliation across time. The president at Hiroshima. Well, a World War II veteran achieved a poignant measure of closure earlier this month. After 71 years of waiting to return to Britain, the place he defended as part of the Allied force facing the Nazis, he got on a plane and at age 94 set foot in the UK one more time. He was the gunner on a B-17 bomber, and he was joyful as he toured the battlefield memorials and museums, according to his stepdaughter who was with him. As he was climbing out of the preserved Battle of Britain bunker, still intact in the borough of Hillington in London, he felt dizzy and then collapsed, and quietly and quickly died right there. His stepdaughter insisted he was happy. His tour, she said, was finally done. The Washington Post noted in its story that it was the exact place where Winston Churchill said, quote, "Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few." Rest in peace, Air Force Master Sergeant Melvin Rector. And if you want to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work. Great way to stay up on the news. Take us to your picnic this weekend. Find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.